Okay, so this, the button up here says live, so I'm going to go ahead and start talking. Hello, everybody. Welcome to a collaborative Read Science Scientific American Hangout, and we have a very special guest here today, Commander Hadfield, former commander of Expedition 35 with the International Space Station, recently retired astronaut. I'm Joanne Manister, a blogger at Scientific American, and just a mad enthusiast for space and, of course, reading and STEM advocacy. So I'm especially pleased to have Chris here today. Joining me is my co-host, Jeff Schomeyer. We do a lot of interviews with authors because we like to ask authors, how do they relate science to the general public? Of course, I see astronauts as our greatest STEM advocates, and they do a fantastic job sharing this. In addition, we also have Clara Moskowitz, who is the space and physics editor at Scientific American, also along for the discussion. Chris, thank you so much for joining us. We are so glad you could join us, considering you are very, very busy with a book tour promoting your book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, with What Going to Space Taught Me About Ingenuity, Determination, and Being Prepared for Anything. But my impression from the book is that this is good advice for everyone. So why don't you say hello to the audience and tell us a little bit about when did you start writing this book?
Well, good day. Thank you very much for the invitation to be part of the Hangout today. It's a treat. I've been traveling all across North America over the last few weeks talking about the content of the book, everything from sitting in bookstores right through to being on Conan the other night. And I started working on the book years ago. In truth, started thinking about a book a long, long time ago. But I wanted to wait until I'd gathered enough useful information to make writing a book worthwhile. And also, as an astronaut for the last 21 years, it's a busy job. It's really demanding and a very experience-rich job. So there wasn't much time to write a book. But as I knew I was getting close to my last space flight and the opportunity to live on the International Space Station, I thought now it made sense. I'm one of the old guys now. I've hopefully got a whole diary full of things that have happened, and time to start putting together a book. So one day, sitting on an airplane, I had my Sudoku book, and I started making notes in the back of it of, okay, when I write this book, how am I going to lay it out? How am I going to tell the stories? Which stories do I want to be sure and remember? And then what's the point of it? What am I writing this book for? What is the real reason that I would even write a book? And it occurred to me when my wife and I were out walking the dogs that it's back on Earth that matters, of course. Nobody really cares what happens in space. What matters is how does it affect us and influence us? And so that's why I just thought one day An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth makes the most sense. And then I wrote the book over a period of a couple of years. But then there was so much stuff happened during the 5 months on the space station that there was a lot of work to do to get it finished this past summer. But finally, got it all done and got it into the publishers on time, and it's multiple publishers, and got it released just before Halloween. And it's a New York Times bestseller now, so that's pretty amazing for someone who never set out to be an author. But I'm really pleased, and thanks for inviting me to talk to folks today.
So the interesting thing is you had to include, what has set you apart from many other astronauts is your social media prowess, which includes assistance from your entire family, it seems.
Sure
so
does.
That was a very important part of this book, and so you did have to wait. I feel like this book wouldn't be complete if you wrote it and then became a social media, you know, star.
Yeah, and there's a lot learned from that. Part of the social media results are purely technological. We didn't have that capability on the space shuttle the first couple times that I flew, and we only recently really got it on the space station, where we have the connectivity and the two-way connectivity, the ability to downlink video from the space station hasn't really existed, at least any sort of high-def video. So I was lucky to arrive on station when all that technology suddenly got up there. And then part of it is just, as the last 20 years as an astronaut, and one of the few Canadian astronauts, the demand for public speaking was really high. And so I've had my share of trying to tell this whole story of how do you relate the really unusual things that astronauts do, the strange ways that we prepare, and the bizarre experiences of, you know, being blinded during a spacewalk or trying to deal with a live snake in my airplane, or the type of strange things that happen. How do you take those stories and then filter out of them what is useful to everybody? And it's something I learned over 20 years of speaking at schools and businesses and government assemblies and things as an astronaut. And the book is very much the grandchild of all of those talks, of a learned way to try and present the information so it's both inherently interesting but also inherently useful. And social media was just another way to do a high school talk, but in this case to a million people.
Our whole theme is with this program is science communication and getting people interested in science by telling interesting stories, meeting interesting people. Anything will do. And I got to know you thanks to Twitter and the photographs that you sent from the space station, which you tell us is largely down to your sons, Evans, convincing you to do the outreach with the social media and marketing space. And that's how tens of thousands of other people have got it, which is, you know, valuable, really valuable for science outreach. But this is nothing new for you either. Interesting people in space has been one of your themes the whole time. So here I am with my essay question of, you know, how to do this, why to do this, how we can become, you know, space rock stars. And it sort of comes down to being an interesting person after a while, it seems like. But this is nothing new for you, really. It's just some of the tools have changed, right?
It's true. When society or your employer labels you as an astronaut, when you start talking to a stranger, you know, you're sitting on a bus or an airplane or in a restaurant, and you're having a normal conversation, and you're a normal-looking person, and then as soon as they discover that you're an astronaut, all conversation ceases. There is no chance anymore for a normal two-way dialogue because the job is so rare that it derails any sort of way to have a normal talk. So I learned a long time ago not to tell people I'm an astronaut for a while because otherwise all I ever do is talk about myself and I never learn anything about anybody else. So when you say that one of the keys to social media is to be an interesting person, the reason I bring this up is everybody is an interesting person. Mm-hmm. And the whole key is in presentation. And if you talk to anybody, if you can, I did it as a self-defense mechanism, but when I'm sitting next to someone, I try and as swiftly as possible start digging through the normal layers of politeness and nothing conversation, small talk, and try and get to the levels where these people know something that I don't know, or they have an insight that I haven't had, or they've had an experience, they've been to a place that I haven't been, and start talking about that, something that where you can see a little light come into their eyes, where you can see them take an interest because you've taken an interest. And you can get there really quickly if you cut out the normal crap of conversation and just start asking someone, so where did you grow up, and you know, what age did you leave home, and why did you take that course in school, and what was the second car you bought, you know, what color interior did you choose on the second car you bought, and get somebody into themselves, and you will learn stuff, and the conversation becomes much more interesting, and that's the part that you need to tell people about in social media. Mm-hmm. They don't want to hear, look at me, buy my soap. They want to hear why what you're doing in life is important to you, or why this made you laugh, or why it made you sad, or some little thing you observed that was new to you, the honesty of it and the personal perspective of it. That is what social media brings, and trying to bring that out. And if a scientist who is who is looking at new particles coming into the alpha magnetic spectrometer can talk about why that's exciting to them, or you know, what as a kid inspired them to think about doing this, or you know, then it becomes the human story that all of us are inherently interested in, and that's what my son coached me on, but also through trial and error that I've learned is effective in social media.
Well, that was a really central theme in the book too, was this sort of the lack of ego, the authentic interest in other people, and one phrase that I really liked when you were doing survivorship training, you talked about developing good leadership skills and good followership skills, and I think that all is part of the picture of being interested in other people, not letting your ego get in the way, and as you said at another point, making someone else look good or feel good does not diminish you.
Right.
It builds both of you up.
Yeah, and it actually, if you can make someone else look good, not only are they liable to exceed themselves and pick up some of the slack, but it gives you a chance to rest. It gives you a chance to try and get your act together and actually notice what's going on while you allow someone else to develop beyond, whether it's for 1 minute or for life, that you allow someone else to develop beyond where they were. It's not dog eat dog all the time. You know, sometimes we're a whole pack of dogs and we need to work together.
Well, that was, you know, the subtitle of the book, I read it, about what going to space taught me about being prepared for anything, which sounds good as a subtitle, but to discover that that's what you were actually talking about was quite a surprise, and that you tell autobiographical stories that are interesting because people don't have a ready instinct about what it's like in space and what preparations you've done, but you also find very interesting lessons from that about how to work well with people and, to some people, you know, how to succeed without making everyone else fail. And those are a really valuable part of the book too. That all gets mixed up with the science, and it all works as a unit. I really enjoyed that.
And part of my motivation also is that people, and by people, I mean the people that pay for the space program, they can't support it or not support it if they don't know it exists. You know, you can't have an opinion about whether we should have a space station or not if you've never heard of it or if you don't know that we have one. And you definitely can't make an informed decision about it if you don't understand what's going on up there. And it's not just a remote place where we do interesting robotic experiments on an esoteric level that don't benefit anyone. It is a whole cornucopia of things. It's hundreds of experiments. It's insight into the universe. It's insight into the world. But it's also insight into ourselves. And social media is an invitation on board to see it for what it really is, not the manufactured or glossy product of what we want people to think what it is, but actually an invitation on board to see all of the raw material of capability that we've put up there. And that is contagious. It interests people beyond the people who are naturally drawn to scientific research, but it draws in people of all walks of life, and that's who are asking to pay for the space station. They have to see everything it can do. And astronauts, you know, people say, when are we going to fly normal people in space? It just cracks me up, like we're some sort of weird, strange subspecies or strange breed in the astronaut office, or we all grew up together or something. If you came to any astronaut social, you would realize we're just a bunch of flawed, normal people doing our best just like anywhere. And so to invite people on board the space station shows that we do have real people on the space station. We have poets and artists and engineers and scientists and photographers and musicians, just like everywhere. And we're trying to make the absolute most of this thing that we've built and let people see the results, and then they speak for themselves, and then people will support it to whatever level they think is appropriate. And that's the way it ought to be.
So the PR people may not be happy, but you and I would probably agree that the immediacy and spontaneity are, on the whole, good things.
Sure. I mean, we don't, you know, you don't get to go live on the space station because you're a myopic idiot And so you don't need to treat the people that are speaking on behalf of the program as if their myopia and their inherent idiocy will cause them to constantly say bad things, you know. And so the openness is important. And people need to think about it. They need to get comfortable communicating. Some people are not comfortable naturally. But we train to do extremely complicated things. We train to do very esoteric things, and they're necessary to live on the space station. And so you can also train people how to communicate what they're up to better, just like any other skill. And NASA does address that, and they work on it, and they try and then encourage people to the maximum extent that their nature allows to communicate what's happening. And our reaction is still catching up to the technology, as it often does, but I think we're going to see more and more of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of having regular people go up in space, the commercial space industry is obviously heating up these days, and more people may soon get the chance to go up there. What do you think about that? And would you ever consider riding Virgin Galactic, for example?
Oh, sure. It's the natural progression. There's all sorts of historical examples of the next generation taking what they were raised with and pushing it to the limit. Whether it is, you know, just my teenage kids leaving home in a huff because they can't stand the environment that they grew up in, or whether it's people leaving a country because of a famine or a change or where they need to seek a better place, or if it's purely just technology allowing us to go someplace that we couldn't go before, like sail across the Atlantic or go live in Antarctica. And the way we've always done that is to have a big organization set up a structure, a comfort base, a financial stability that allows us to start sending out probes. And then we send probes. In my family, in 1827, I think, they sent a probe to Canada from Scotland. And it was a 19-year-old. But they sent their 19-year-old son to Montreal as a probe. Go be Mars Curiosity rover for us. We want you to go to Montreal, have a look around, see if it's habitable, see what life could be like over there, see if there's opportunity, and then report back. And then we will make a community decision as to whether we're going to move there or not. We did that in Antarctica. We've been sending probes down there, and we realized with, you know, like Shackelford and, or Shackleton and all the other early efforts, and then we found that not only is it possible to live there, but it's scientifically worthwhile. And we set up the various bases. Until now, we have almost 100 people who live at the South Pole year-round, and we're understanding our world as a result. And so going to space is just the next logical progression of that. We've built the technology that we've sent probes almost everywhere, and now, based on what we found, we have left Earth. And the space station is a permanent habitation away from Earth for the last 13 years, this month. And we're now just trying to decide, okay, just like my family did in 1827, where do we go next? What do we do next? What makes sense for the overall health of our big family? And so commercial spaceflight then starts moving into that. This big structure is there. When can it be possible that it's not just the government who can afford to go as one of these probes or as an entity, but maybe us, just a company or maybe just a private citizen could afford to start going to this new place? And the way that Virgin Galactic has done it is they are the first one that is really targeting private citizens to be able to be the business model of their whole company. And it seems like a lot of money, you know, $250,000, but there are a lot of people who buy $250,000 cars.
Right. Yeah.
And obviously that's a luxury, that's not a necessity. And if there's that many people buying a $250,000 car, then there is an opportunity for that amount of money to be spent to go and travel to space. And you have to start somewhere. And it's going to be expensive at first, and we're going to learn a lot of lessons. And from that, we will probably find a way to make it cheaper or more targeted at a cheaper audience. You know, the very first airline wasn't Southwest. The very first airlines were very expensive, targeted at the very well-to-do. And only over time could we figure out how to make it more common. And so, yeah, it's not easy and it's not cheap, but it's the important start. And Richard Branson is both brave and prescient and wealthy enough to be able to take a lot of gamble and set this up. And I'm not sure he has it right. but he's the only one who's trying really seriously at the forefront right now, and I think he's within about 9 months of flight. And sure, I'd love to go for a ride, but you know, I'm spoiled, right? I've lived in space, and to go for a short ride, you know, I would have to convince myself, for me, why it's worth the money. But the inherent idea of it, I think, is great.
And when you go out and meet people, do you sense? When you go out and meet people, do you sense a lot of enthusiasm in the general public to go to space?
Oh yeah, for the idea of space travel, I'm one of the, you know, when you wear a blue suit as an astronaut, you get a credibility that maybe you haven't even earned. But when you show up in a high school gymnasium wearing an astronaut's blue suit and you've been to space once, then you get direct attention of 1,000 students, at least for a while. And so therefore, you get to see directly reflected back what the interest level is. And as adults get older and older, they tend to get a little more, established in their thinking. And something that they were excited about when they were 18 or 20 has long sort of faded into memory. And so they start to think that everybody is the same as them. They go, well, I used to be excited about space travel, but now I'm 55 and I've become this job and I've become this person. So therefore, nobody's interested in space travel anymore. You start to project your own life onto everyone else. But I directly talk to tens of thousands of students all the time, and I see the same fundamental desire and interest and burning curiosity and hope of being able to do that sometime in their life as I experienced and the kids around me experienced when I was a kid. I get direct feedback from it. And so I kind of put down people who say, oh, well, we used to be interested in spaceflight, but we aren't anymore. That's you know, largely effect of a natural process of specialization with age. And I think there's enormous interest. It'll really be self-limiting by cost. If it costs $250,000 for one ride, there's only a small slice of our society that can afford that. But over time, just like luxury liner travel and then luxury train travel and then luxury air travel, eventually we'll get out of luxury space travel and find a way to make it more accessible. It's going to take time, but we'll get there.
So what do you say, you know, as I said in the introduction, I love astronauts are these visible advocates for STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. So what do you do to encourage students along those lines? Because none of this is going to happen if we don't have brilliant people, engineers and mathematicians and scientists, building these things that get us to space. So what do you recommend specifically?
Well, you need to inspire your young people to try and do something that is currently impossible or just barely possible. You need to give them the reassurance that they can afford to work towards something that is right on the edge of the capability of your society. And convince them of it early. I went to New York and I spoke to the folks at Tumblr about 2 weeks ago. And Tumblr, you know, it's a social media capability and it's very new. The CEO is 27 years old and it's a place of great creativity and great financial success. They are creating great wealth through the inventiveness of some young minds that are taking advantage of a new technology. And none of them are astronauts, and nothing they're doing will get them into space, but they are fascinated with space flight. They're inspired by space flight. They're motivated by space flight. They think that this facet of our civilization is one of the core things that really excites them, and it drove them just through that natural curiosity into technological fields, into becoming the software and the social media savants that they are and leaders that they are. You need that in the fabric of your society. And not everyone's going to want to be an astronaut, but the people that design your cars, they are fascinated by spaceflight. It's contagious. And you have to impress upon people young that those opportunities exist. You have to show them that there's a horizon beyond the one that maybe they're growing up with in their village or their town or their school. You have to show them somehow that all of these things exist. And that's why the educational side, the outreach side, social media isn't just for seeing what a pop star has done this week. And social media is also for showing the cool stuff that's going on within all of society and the challenges and opportunities that come within it. And the more effectively we can communicate what is right on the fringes of our capability, the more it will inspire our young people, and then they will, through their own natural curiosity, pursue a career in science, technology, engineering, and math, and the arts, and all of them fold together. And that's a lot of my motivation in how I conducted myself for 21 years as an astronaut.
So are all the STEM things as well as art things, and we've agreed with many people before that art and creativity is a big part of, should always go along with science and technology and things too. And combine that with a theme from your book where you're talking about preparedness or always being ready to sing Rocket Man.
Yeah.
You know, using your time productively to learn things instead of not learning things as a way, because you never know quite what you're going to be presented with.
Yeah, it's funny. I grew up on a farm, and being a farmer is a lot of practical skill training, right? You're always repairing something that broke, or you're 5 miles away from the barn and something broke on your tractor, and you have to fix it with the tools that are available. It's a very practical apprenticeship of how to go through things, and you're constantly trying to invent and get yourself ready for the next thing that's coming. And it applies sometimes in spaceflight. I never knew that some of the training that I got on the farm was actually my apprenticeship for breaking into a Russian space station. But there I was on my very first space flight, and we docked with Mir, and now I'm trying to open up the hatch that will, after we've equalized pressure, that will let us to enter into the Russian space station, and it has been tied down and strapped up and secured by some great big strong Russian engineer, and my only way to break in is with my Swiss Army knife. And so, but that's what you use on a tractor all the time, and all the little tools on the end. And I took everything apart and got it unbuttoned and unstrapped and unscrewed and managed to then, and at the time I remember taking my Swiss Army knife and holding it up to the camera and floating it there for my brother, who's a big fan of Swiss Army knives, and just kind of laughing at how all of those practical years of farm life were in fact training for that unexpected moment later in my life. And the practical lesson out of that is the things that you learn, all they do is increase your base of capability to deal with surprises in the future and deal with situations that otherwise you might be ill-prepared for. And if you've got 10 minutes and you know something's about to happen, like, for example, if I told you you are going to address the United Nations in 10 minutes, what are you going to do with your 10 minutes? And you might just panic, or you might look for an exit and try and run away, or you might do nothing, or you might go, okay, I got 10 minutes. This is a time to prepare. Let's get online and get 4 important facts that I want to make, and then write an introduction, write a conclusion, and go from there. And I sort of treat my whole life like maybe at some point in the future, I'm going to be doing this thing, so let's start gathering those skills and keeping focused on, you know, what's the next thing that's going to kill me, or at least the next thing that's going to kill me with embarrassment, and get myself ready for that. And then it makes life really interesting. You're constantly learning new stuff. You're gaining new skills. And the second time you need to speak at the United Nations, you're comfortable because you were already prepared the first time.
The answer to the question, is this going to be on the quiz, is that everything is on the quiz sooner or later.
Yeah, everything's on the quiz sooner or later. You just never know when your quiz is going to be graded.
Mm-hmm. Or at least you can use it all on the quiz at some point.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Hey, you know what? We have a lot of teachers are watching with their students. So I'm definitely happy for that. And we've even got here a special hello to Chris from all of the teachers, parents, and students from Chris Hadfield Public School in Bradford, Ontario. So I guess they tune in whenever they can. So that's so exciting that, you know, the teachers let me know that they're going to be watching, that they're tuning in. And that must be where you end up a lot.
It is, and I've of course made a great effort to speak at schools because John Cleese did a series several years ago about when you kind of form your opinions on the world, and it's sort of called "You Are What You Were When," but the idea being that what you value in life at 10 years old, the things that you've recognized as important to you at 10 years old, the things you've been shown at 10 years old, they kind of set the pattern for you of what you think might be possible in your life or where you think you might fit into life. And 10 years old, you know, whatever that is, grade 5, is a really critical time in life for that reason. And there's a big dichotomy between a 7-year-old and a 10-year-old as their awareness of the world and their start into adult decision-making. So someone who's been as privileged as I am, who has had so many people teach me things, to have the opportunity to go and talk to kids at that age is an absolute obligation of a responsibility, I thought, and I still think. And that's why I seek out opportunities, and I have, and I've spoken at thousands of schools over the year. I started a program at work called On the Lunch Pad, where I thought, I'm sitting at my desk eating my sandwich, and there's thousands of kids sitting at their desks eating their sandwich, and we all have Skype. Why don't I just Skype with a school while I'm having lunch, you know? And so I would just join in with some classroom somewhere at some school, and we just eat our peanut butter sandwiches together while we were talking to each other. And why not? Otherwise, what would I do during lunch? I'd surf the internet or read the news or whatever. So why not? And I think it's really important. And that's I'm pleased to hear that the folks at the new Chris Hadfield Public School are tied in today. And hello to all the teachers and students there.
So once you get past that question about the toilets, what do you talk with fifth graders about? What's on their minds? What do you tell them?
When I speak with adults, one of the most common questions is, what's it like in space? And to me, it's actually a disappointing question, because it's like asking, what's it like to live on Earth? It's such an unfocused undug into question that it's also one, to me, that is a little self-revealing, in that the person that's asking the question doesn't really think they're ever going to go. And they mostly just want you to be a travel guide for them to say what it was like. When you talk to a 10-year-old, they have not ruled that out of their life. In fact, they have a reason, it's a career choice still for them. And so they won't ask, so what's it like in space? Oh, am I still there? My image just went away.
Yep, you're okay. Are here. Nope.
And so they will instead ask really thought-out questions. You know, how does this thing work? How does that behave? What's this particular phase feel like? How come this doesn't happen? You know, and you ask about the toilet. You know, that's just all part of the whole thing. They want to know the specifics. They want to prepare themselves. They want to fill out the imaginative parts where they've had some independent thinking, and they're trying to truly visualize what it's going to be like for them. And so I really enjoy talking at the school level, because they're much more engaged in the answers than it'd be like me asking somebody, so, you know, what was it like when you went to the Taj Mahal? I just sort of want a little travel guide to it, but I'm not planning to go to the Taj Mahal myself. If I knew I was going to the Taj Mahal, I would ask quite different questions. And so that curiosity is what I see when I speak to schools, and it's really refreshing to see that.
So in my time on social media and dealing, especially with young ladies who may or may not be interested in science, what I am increasingly, I'm asked all the time, how do you get young people interested in science, especially girls? What I'm convincing myself more and more that it really is meeting someone inspiring, someone enthusiastic, someone who loves what they do, and that people know that that option exists in life. And that's what astronauts do, and that's where I feel like, you know, people in science like me need to get out, and, well, I do go out, and, you know, get out and just go, this is really cool, you can do it, and guess what, I'm a woman, you're a girl, you can do this.
And social media is so easy for that. It allows us to not have to get out. Given 30 minutes, you can spend 28 minutes, no matter where you are, talking with someone about something that might be useful. And from the side of whether being a man or a woman, of course, in our business is important, it's irrelevant. The director of the Johnson Space Center is Ellen Ochoa, who's a multiply flown astronaut. The chief of flight operations for all of the Johnson Space Center is Janet Cavandi, who's a flown astronaut. And up until just a little while ago, the chief of the entire astronaut office is Peggy Whitson. And she was also the commander of the International Space Station. And Pam Melroy was the commander of the space shuttle. And Eileen Collins, I mean, what matters is competence and drive and education and a willingness to learn all those things on your behalf. And all of those positions of experience and science and engineering and authority and responsibility for the future of the nation's space program, they are in the hands of these extremely capable, competent people who also happen to be women. And so people just need to see that. They need to recognize that it's not a limitation based on maybe some sort of stereotype or some sort of other influence, but in fact the limitation lies within yourself. And having a good example, as you say, can really help you see that the limitations that you think you have within yourself are false, and that you're maybe looking at the wrong example or just haven't met the right person yet.
Were you consciously using some of these tools that other astronauts hadn't gotten into as much before, like music or humor, to reach people that maybe didn't know they were interested in space or interested in what's going on up there?
Both consciously, I think, Clara, I was both consciously and unconsciously I was doing that. But it's really just sort of an extension of myself. I wasn't like playing some chess game where I wanted to move king's pawn to king's queen six in order to accomplish some objective. It's just I love music, and I'm an engineer, and I'm a test pilot, and I'm an astronaut. And it's not like astronauts way up here and music is way down here. It's just stuff that I like to do. And for me, it's another natural challenge and human activity and a way of enjoying life. And things are funny. Everybody has a sense of humor, you know, and there's stuff that make you laugh constantly if you just notice it. And so in just open communication, I'm just as happy to talk about the complexity of maneuvering a spaceship, allowing for orbital mechanics when you're coming into dock, as I am the complexity of changing from a B minor to an F sharp minor when you're learning to play guitar for the first time, or the complexity of telling a joke properly and bringing yourself back around to a recurring joke theme in a conversation so that you can get a laugh. Those are all just fun and things to talk about and ways of noticing and enjoying what's happening with the people that you're talking with.
Mm-hmm.
There's a question here from a viewer, and it will segue to something I do like to ask it. Muhammad asks, in one of your videos, you mentioned you read Steve Jones, Darwin's Ghost, on your mission. Was reading a book in space much more thrilling than on Earth?
That book, Darwin's Ghost, is interesting. It's by an author who took Darwin's Origin of the Species and then tried to update it using a lot of the research and genome data and a lot of the stuff that's come since. I found it quite a thought-provoking book to read in orbit. And in fact, I would learn stuff in each chapter, kind of challenge my own thinking, and I'd bring the conversation to the astronaut dinner table so that when we were together having dinner that night, then I could talk about something I'd read in the book the night before. So it was really good as a way to bring new ideas on board. It's weird reading a book in space, actually, because when you're reading it, you've got the page open, you can let go, and the book floats in front of you, which is kind of fun. And sometimes, you know how sometimes when you read a book and you fall asleep and the book sort of falls into your lap, well, in the space station, if you read and fall asleep, after a while, the book will float up and bounce off your forehead and maybe wake up. So I noticed it was kind of an odd, but I liked it on a paper book up there because there's just a certain comfort in holding a page and reading the same paragraph that was really thoughtful, reading it three or four times or thinking about it. And it was a nice, tangible link with home. And so I really enjoyed reading and getting some new thoughts of that particular book while I was in orbit. And we have a pretty good library, both an electronic library as well as a print library of books on the space station.
Well, that's fantastic. So if you were to suggest a few books for our viewers, especially our younger viewers, for inspiration, what would you recommend?
Well, you know, I'd be really biased because I know the things that I'm interested in. And what I would recommend instead is when you go to a bookstore or you go to a library and you start looking at the topics that are there, which ones naturally draw you over? Mm. What naturally attracts you? If you see one, say, with, pictures of Yosemite, or if you see one that talks about birds, or you see one that talks about music, what naturally draws your attention? Or if you're flicking the channels on TV and you see something and you naturally stop at that channel and look at it and watch that one. Or if you overhear people talking in the seat in the bus next to you and you're just ignoring their conversation until you hear one topic and you go, huh, and you kind of listen. What are those things that you're naturally curious about? And then read that book. And don't just read the Entertainment Tonight version of that book, but read the book that will actually teach you about it. If you're interested in football, then read a really detailed, read about the invention of football, about how shoulder pads actually protect the shoulder joints. Learn about how helmets are stopping concussions or not stopping concussions. Understand, learn how the rules were invented and how the change of the rules over time have changed the game or improved the game. Or if you're interested, you know, learn the technology and the thought behind the things that you're naturally interested in. And there's an unlimited resource of books to do that. And when I tend to try and read books that teach me something, or that when I get to the dinner table that night where I can talk more intelligently about a topic than I could this morning, because it engenders conversation amongst everybody. And so there's all sorts of books that appeal to me. And if you want to read a really good book about spaceflight, of course you should read my book, but if you really want to read a good book about spaceflight, I think Mike Collins' book, Carrying the Fire, is a tremendous book about the early days of spaceflight, a really nice insight into what it was like to be an Apollo astronaut and to orbit the moon. Or Before the Dawn, to me, is a fascinating book, which I read recently, or The Third Chimpanzee. It's not that I agree with everything those writers thought, but they've taken something that I had a passing interest in, and they have dug way, way deep into it and taken that thought process right to the end so that then I can go, you know, I really disagree with that. Or, you know, I really agree with that. And I'm going to maybe view the world a little differently because of the thought process that someone else has done on my behalf.
We may be getting perilously close now to our summarizing time where we either start to wrap it up or we've got, like, you know, 3 hours worth more. So I'm going to say, yes, people should read your book because not only do they get a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of interest in space things. I've got one right here behind me. And, you know, your personality through it. But there are lots of preparedness about space and excitement, but also lots of really valuable lessons that apply to everything that a younger person might learn for living a really good life. And so here's one quotation that I wanted you to summarize, to end on. It's like, you say, it's never either or, never enjoyment versus advancement. So long as you conceive of advancement in terms of learning rather than climbing to the next rung of the professional ladder. And I think that's a lot of what we've been talking about today, too. And I think that's a really fine lesson.
You know, when you come back from the space station, in my last flight, I commanded the International Space Station. It's kind of like the world's spaceship, and I was trusted to command that thing. And so it's a very high level, not only of responsibility, but it's quite a high honor. It's quite a high, rare level of recognition. And you could come back thinking you're pretty special, or that from now on, everything else should be somehow at that level or something. But being an astronaut fortunately, that doesn't happen, because you come back from that flight, and the next person goes to command the spaceship, and when you come back, you're physically deflated. You have to recover from the experience, but you roll back into the astronaut office like I did for 21 years, and you now become the deputy assistant manager of payload safety review. And it's a really important job, and we have to do it to safely fly in space. But it keeps things in perspective. You support the other people that fly in space. The job that you do is making space flight safer. And even though it was your turn for a while to hold the tiller and to be in charge, climbing down the ladder is not a negative. Climbing down the ladder is actually just another thing that happens and that could have just as positive a results. And so the perspective of that is important. It's one that's naturally fed to us in our job, and therefore it's one I tried to explain and include in the book to the best of my ability so that you can get the whole picture and not just evaluate your life based on the individual small peaks that might happen.
Wow. Well, everybody, we do not want to hold up Commander Hadfield much longer. I'm sure he's got a busy schedule. This could go on for hours. Thanks to everybody who sent us questions. I know we couldn't get to all of them, but you know, if you catch him at a book signing, you might be able to ask him, because he is touring everywhere. You probably don't stop talking. Do pick up his book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. It is really good. His personality shines through. You can tell that family's important. He adores his wife, and we want to thank her for being tech support back there with him. And everybody, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, Clara, for your presence and your questions. And Jeff, of course, is always a pleasure to work with you. Thank you to everybody on behalf of Scientific American for joining us for this Hangout with Commander Hadfield. We'll see you again soon.
Thanks. Nice to talk with everybody. Thank you.